This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm George Levesque. Decades after it was thought to have been eradicated in Texas, the New World screwworm is on the move. Officials are taking steps they hope will help prevent a disaster for Texas cattle, but they're also asking hunters to be on the lookout for evidence that the pest is spreading through the Lone Star State. KACU's Leslie Kerrigan has more.
The New World screwworm is a parasitic fly that lays eggs in open wounds or in the nose, eyes, or mouth of warm-blooded animals. Once the eggs are laid, they hatch into maggots, or screwworms, which burrow or screw themselves into the wound and feed on the healthy flesh of the animal. Dr. Hunter Reed is a wildlife veterinarian for the Texas Parks and Wildlife. He says the screwworm was originally eradicated in the U.S., but is slowly coming back.
Around 50 years ago, it was pushed all the way down to Panama. However, with some complications with COVID, as well as some illegal cattle movements, we've seen that parasite encroach back up into Mexico.
It brought fear to my heart. A rancher, you want to send him to his knees, just say, screw worm.
Sam Snyder is a board member for the Texas Farm Bureau and a rancher in Callahan and Shackelford counties. He remembers seeing the devastation brought by the New World screwworm on his family's herd firsthand.
Anybody who knows what it is just terrified of it. And that's huge. It's huge. Let us hope that we don't get back where we were in the 50s, because a screwworm can be devastating. It can be much worse than anybody now realizes, because when it gets here, there's not much you can do about it.
It is hard to battle the pest. Experts say the best approach is to fight the spread with sterilized flies. U.S. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins has been working on the problem since April, with Texas top agriculture official Commissioner Sid Miller backing her efforts. Officials recently celebrated the opening of a sterile fly dispersal facility in Tampico, Mexico. Flies will be dispersed across northeastern Mexico with the goal of dispersing 100 million sterile flies weekly. Officials say this effort will help push the New World screwworm south over the winter. But this pest does not only attack cattle. And now the hunting season is underway, Dr. Hunter Reed says state officials are urging hunters to help monitor for it in wildlife.
You can look for animals that are A, living, and B, that might have small or large wounds with maggots inside those wounds. So this might be hard to see from a distance, but if an animal is recently harvested and you see larvae in a wound, please notify our department or your local biologist so that we can get someone out there to try and take samples and really try and surveil for this.
Once cattle or other animals are infected, there is treatment, but it's very involved. And if the screwworm has spread widely through a herd, it will take more work than most ranchers have time to invest.
This can be a pretty arduous endeavor because some of these wounds can contain hundreds of thousands of larvae. But being able to remove every single maggot out of those wounds is imperative, making sure that those wounds are covered.
While screwworms are mainly an issue for animals, Reed says they can infect humans. The Maryland Health Department confirmed a human case in August in a person who had traveled to South America.
Yes, so humans are susceptible to New World screwworm, especially those that might have issues taking care of themselves, those that might be homeless, out of doors. So it's important for folks that might be traveling to some areas in Central and South America to be aware and make sure they don't bring screwworm back. But also humans should, if they do have wounds that might be infested with maggots, really seek their primary care physician and try and get it treated.
According to health officials, the patient in Maryland has recovered and the risk to people in the U.S. remains low. For now, their priority is combating the spread among cattle and wildlife, and they are asking anyone who sees New World screwworm in livestock to report it to the Texas Animal Health Commission. And if a hunter suspects screwworm in wildlife species, they can reach out to Texas Parks and Wildlife at tpwd.texas.gov. I'm Leslie Kerrigan in Abilene.
Across the South Plains, traces of indigenous history remain. in the stories families passed down, and in the land that once sustained their entire nations. KTTZ reporter Bishop Van Buren says that many Native people in West Texas want to see that history better recognized and preserved.
Cindy Slaughter is a founder of Native American People of the Plains and Beyond. Her work focuses on preserving the history, traditions, and cultural practices of indigenous peoples in West Texas, and her nonprofit's mission is to educate and unite communities through recognition and cultural exchange, work she says is long overdue. Texas officially recognized the second Monday in October, a day that's been celebrated as Columbus Day in America for almost a century, as Indigenous Peoples Day in 2021. Another thing Slaughter called overdue, but something she's still grateful for.
We were here before you know who decided he wanted to come over and take charge. It means so very much for the people to be recognized finally. They have been pushed to the bottom of the pile so often that it's almost impossible for any of us to stand up and proudly say that we are Native American. But to have Texas stand beside us and acknowledge the fact that we are here, we're still here, means everything to us as a people.
Though Native people represent a small portion of the population in the region, just over 1% in Lubbock County, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, their cultural impact stretches far beyond the numbers. Slaughter said visibility is key to survival, and celebration is one of the most powerful tools. Her group is now planning a major powwow for November of 2026, the first large-scale event of its kind in Lubbock since 2012. The celebration will gather tribal dancers, veterans, artisans, and food vendors from across Texas and beyond.
You're going to see so many different tribal affiliations. The dancers that do go out and dance, they're all representing their heritage, and every group is different. And it's a wonderful experience because it does give people an inside look at who we are.
For Slaughter, celebration and education go hand in hand, a chance not only to give insight into a culture, but also to challenge myths and misconceptions.
It's still not taught as it should be. And that's just the truth, you know, that the Columbus is so good and it's not really being taught for what it really is.
She keeps a binder full of broken treaties, a record of promises made and forgotten, as a reminder that history isn't something to move past, but something that continues to shape Native lives. That sense of reconnection is what drives Ken LeBlanc, a 77-year-old resident of Post, Texas, whose wife Shirley is Comanche. He recalls when Bruce Parker, great-grandson of legendary Comanche leader Quanah Parker, visited the National Ranching Heritage Center in 2019 to bless beadwork that once belonged to Quanah. He shared a conversation he had with Parker about a scenic overlook in Post where visitors can gaze off the Cap Rock.
And he said, I came across there and he said, I started crying. He said, you look out there and you realize that you can look 360 degrees and everything you see at one time was Comanche.
LeBlanc is an example of how for many families, identity is rediscovered rather than inherited. He says his wife Shirley didn't remember she is Comanche until her sister shared old family stories. Remembrance is why he now spends much of his time making beaded necklaces to sell at powwows, and while Slaughter has her binder of broken promises, LeBlanc has his ceremonial smoking pipe.
Indians do not take that smoke into their lungs. It's called kniknik. They say their prayers, and they take that into their mouth, and then they blow that out to God, and it carries their prayers to God. This thing here has caused more deaths than anything else between Native Americans and Euro-Americans. The reason why is the Europeans, it was just an old pipe. To the Indians, this is sacred, and if you make a promise on this, you better keep it.
Across Texas, there are roughly 268,000 people who identify as either American Indian or Alaska Native, a small but vibrant 1% of the state's population, according to data from Every Texan. For Slaughter, those numbers tell a story of quiet endurance, one she hopes to make louder.
We all look different, but we're all still here. And I think that it would just be wonderful if they would just get a sense of curiosity to send them out on the first adventure in the first place, and then go on from there. They would be really surprised.
In 2012, Slaughter attended the last powwow held near Lubbock. It was there she received her native name, Mazaska Itza, meaning golden eyes. The event stayed with her for years.
I wrestled with, should we try to bring this back? And I went to my husband and I said, Rex, is just weighing on my soul. We need to bring this back to Lubbock.
Since then, her organization has become a 501c3 nonprofit, supported by the Lubbock Cultural Arts Foundation and Civic Lubbock, Inc. Her dream is for the 2026 powwow to become an annual tradition, one that restores the connection between Indigenous culture and the land that once sustained it.
We're trying to bring recognition not only to the people, but also an experience for the general public to understand this is who we are, we're still here, we're inviting you to come in and experience it with us. You're more than welcome. That's what the powwow is about.
I'm Bishop Van Buren in Lubbock.
The holidays are upon us, and while songs and marketing tell us that it's the most wonderful time of the year, it's really not for a lot of people. Beyond the packed calendar, the financial stress, the social pressure that can dampen the holiday spirit, lots of people find grief makes this time of year especially hard. A 2021 poll indicated 36% of Americans don't look forward to the holidays because they're dealing with loss or grief. Hendrick Hospice Care offers help for people who are experiencing grief. Adriana Golden-Smith, bereavement coordinator at Hendrick Hospice Care, is here to give us some insight on how grieving individuals and families can approach the holidays. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for letting me be here.
You know, it's radio and they can't see your face, but you're smiling ear to ear. And I think it's important to say that. This is going to be, I think, the first opportunity a lot of people have to get together when this comes up. Lots of families travel together to share Thanksgiving. And what's the first piece of advice you have for someone who may be dreading that family gathering because of that grieving experience?
Yeah, I think it's okay to be dreading it. I want to just validate that experience. You mentioned that the holidays are a season and a time where everything is merry and bright and wonderful. And when we're grieving, it sure don't feel like that. And so it can feel very isolating to not be fitting into what we're told the season is supposed to feel like. So I just want to begin by saying it's okay to not be okay. There's space for you to not be okay.
Is it okay to skip, or do you really need to engage with family and friends?
I think what makes the holidays meaningful is what we make of it and not what we're told to make of it. And so if the holidays are meaningful by being engaged in them, wonderful. If they're meaningful by abstaining from them, that's okay too. It really is as personal as the individual person.
If I have a family member who's grieving and maybe they say they don't feel like coming to a big gathering, should I back off and give them space? What should I do?
I think it's always best to follow the lead of the griever. Often we may not know what we need, but we probably know what we need better than others think they know what we need. So if we are receiving some clear boundaries from a loved one saying, I don't want to participate in something, respectfully following those boundaries is always the best course of action.
Things change over the course of time. I think we're a lot more digitally connected than we used to be. But it seems like that those times when family gets together, for so many families, it's fewer and far between. So this is a rare opportunity coming up to get together.
Yeah. And you're right. The technology also gives us ways to stay connected to loved ones that we may not be physically close to. We have this way to bridge geographical distance through technology.
What about outside of those family meals or parties? Do you have any advice for how family members can support their loved ones who may be experiencing grief on any given day?
Yeah. Beginning with just remembering the basics. So first off, don't avoid me. My grief is not contagious. I know it's not necessarily fun to be around. I don't necessarily want to be in it either, and yet I am. So don't avoid me. Reach out and show up. Your presence, your sweet presence, it's truly a gift. It's a present in and of itself in this gift and this season of gifts and presents. You don't have to know the right thing to say. Often there's no right thing to say. Don't pretend like the holidays are going to be the same because they're not. And that's okay. That's part of living with grief after the loss of a loved one. Say their name. Share memories. Share your feelings if you're missing them too. Too often people ignore or avoid saying names or sharing memories or acknowledging grief because we're afraid of reminding people who are grieving that they're grieving. As if they're not already thinking of their loved one every single moment of every single day. So your acknowledgement of the elephant in the room is just so powerful, so meaningful. And then don't force me to be okay. I'm not okay, probably won't be okay, and that is okay. Just gently encourage me, support me, be understanding if I need to change my mind, even at the very last minute. I'm wounded, but I'm not broken. And so in that wounding, I need time for healing and I need time for rest. So give me space for both of those things.
If I could sum up everything you've said in these last few questions, it seems like the word is listen. Really pay attention to what the other person has to say, how they feel.
Yeah, yeah. And I think listening is also a part of our own grief work. That's what I would encourage people who are grieving to do. Listen to what you need. Set boundaries when you need to. Ask for help when you need it. And accept that help when it's offered. That's another hard thing to do, but it's important. Listen to what kinds of things you need to be doing to take care of yourself, whether that's proactively preparing or reactively engaging in self-care after you've encountered some stress or distress. That listening is a big part of it.
Of course, each person's grief is unique. Is there advice for how someone who finds the holidays extra painful can move through these next few weeks? Balancing maybe a desire to honor the memory of their loved ones and navigating all the things that come with the holiday season.
Yeah. Sometimes when I'm needing to extend myself a little bit more grace to make grief embodied. And so thinking about grief as this person that needs caring for, just in the same way every other person needs caring for. So don't ignore her. Honor her. There's this beautiful poem by Uli Kay that says she's talking about grief and how we avoid it, how it feels uncomfortable and we've ignored it and pushed it to the side. And it, when it eventually shows up, the person looks at it and sees how beautiful it is and is astonished at how grief is presented in this beautiful way. And grief responds, "You just hadn't seen me dressed as love yet." So consider inviting grief in as a guest and what ways you can be kind to her and to you.
We may be imagining a grandparent who's facing the loss of their spouse. What about the kids? How is the advice different for helping kids that are grieving through the holidays?
Yeah, I think it's good to acknowledge kids are often what's called disenfranchised grievers. So we forget about them. We don't acknowledge that their grief is real and valid just as much as an experience in a bigger body. That's the only difference between a kid and an adult. It's just the size of the container. So give them opportunities and space to engage in their grief. Include them in traditions, in ways you're honoring your loved one. Help them set a place at the table for the person who's missing. Let them light the candle in honor of that loved one. Help them pick out a gift to send to somebody in that person's honor. Help them write down lessons that they learned, memories that they cherish, things that they remember of their loved one. Including them is a very meaningful way.
Are there any no-nos? Are there some things that when we're sitting there at the dinner table or sitting there watching the game after that we just really need to avoid saying during these times?
I don't know that there's a blanket thing that I can say of not to do or not to say other than just generally not ignoring, avoiding, or downplaying the reality of grief in the holiday season.
Very good advice. I knew that after talking to you, you have all these great ideas and they're so positive that when I said the word no-nos, that was going to be something that made you take a double take. Because it sounds like listening is first,
yeah.
Paying attention to where they are and seeing where the grievers are in your family. Adriana, we know that you guys just held an event for this grief that's going on during the holidays. But of course, there's more to it than just that. If I want to find out what you guys are doing, what programs you have to offer, where do I go? What do I need to know?
The best way to get a hold of us would be through our website, hendrickhospice.org/grief support has tons of online resources as well as my direct contact information. We host a variety of bereavement programs throughout the year for both adults, children, families. Everything is free and everything is open to the whole community, regardless of whether or not you've used a hospice or our hospice services. We also acknowledge that grief is beyond just loss by death. And so our children's programs in particular acknowledge that grief comes through divorce, separation, incarceration, deployment, any kind of separation from a loved one.
Adriana, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for caring about grief in the holidays.
And for on behalf of all of us that have lost someone, and maybe Hendrick helped, including my family, through, we want to thank you so much for all you guys do. Adriana Golden-Smith is bereavement coordinator at Hendrick Hospice Care, and there are resources and links for help with bereavement and grief, including at the holidays, hendrickhealth.org, and that's their website. This is the West Texas Dispatch. For many people, cemeteries are a place they leave their loved ones to rest. They may visit from time to time, but the cemetery is always there, with new burials needing to be arranged and grounds to be maintained. Lubbock's cemetery has seen a sometimes tense history that reflects the West Texas city's history. KTTZ reporter Samantha Larned has more.
The City of Lubbock Cemetery is municipally run as part of the Parks and Recreation Department. Before the city took over in 1948, the land was made up of multiple different cemeteries, and the grounds were separated by race, religion, and economic status. On paper, the cemetery was integrated after the Civil Rights Act in 1964, but de facto segregation continued for years. Helen Washington is the operations manager at the City of Lubbock Cemetery. Washington has been with the cemetery since 2011. She was a City of Lubbock employee for a few years, but her department was being dissolved. She says working at the cemetery took some adjustment, and some people still don't understand how she does it.
After getting out here and seeing what it was all about, it's really interesting, you know, learning the history, and I'm kind of like a detailed person, so like how the graves are laid out.
The cemetery's first burial was in 1892, Henry Jenkins.
The story is that he was here in Lubbock at a hotel downtown, I want to say Nicolet, but he got sick and he died.
Jenkins' headstone reads, Henry Jenkins, a cowboy, aged about 32 years, died March 10, 1892, and was the first person buried in the cemetery. Jenkins' grave is one of several that is marked on the cemetery map, along with Buddy Holly, Mac Davis, and other famous West Texans. Lubbock Cemetery is 132 acres. The city website says there are more than 60,000 burials on the grounds. Washington says that's the estimate she heard when she was brought on in 2011. Her team handles about 350 to 400 burials a year, meaning an additional 4,900 to 5,600 burials in her time with the cemetery, all handled by her grounds crew.
When we're at full staff out on the grounds, we have four crew members, and then we have one person here in the office.
Along with helping folks find their loved ones on the grounds, office staff are contacted by funeral homes or by the families to make burial arrangements. Those who don't own property are invited to purchase land or a spot in the mausoleum.
Usually, well, we start off by asking them if they have other family members here that maybe we can get close to if that's what they want, or if they just want to see what we have available. But some of them want to go outside and see if there's a tree nearby.
A casket is required for non-cremation burial at the Lubbock Cemetery, as is the minimum of a concrete vault surrounding it. Washington says the vaults help keep prairie dogs out of the graves.
Prairie dogs can dig pretty much through about anything.
In addition to maintenance, burial, and prairie dog disposal, the grounds crew is responsible for filling in cave-ins of grave sites.
We've gotten a lot of rain this year. Sometimes they collapse, and that can cause like some of the headstones to fall over. And if we see that, we don't wait for the family to come out and take care of that.
For the most part, though, families are responsible for upkeep, tending to their plot, cleaning headstones, and placing flowers or other decorations. With the West Texas State Veterans Cemetery set to open in Lubbock in December, the marker for Congressional Medal of Honor recipient George Andrew Davis will be taken down at the city cemetery and a new one will be put up at the State Veterans Cemetery. Currently, Washington is dealing with a first. Someone left an urn on the office porch. On it was a sticky note with a year, name, and rank, explaining that it was found during an estate sale.
This is really old. Still waiting to find out who it is, so maybe I can find out where to put it, where to bury it.
While this is her first doorstep drop-off, she has had family mail urns without finalizing any arrangements. Sometimes, Washington says, people pass away while arranging a loved one's burial, and it gets passed on to another family member. Washington herself has family in the cemetery, and she will occasionally go visit them.
I came out here in June of 2011. My mom passed away in September that same year. It's like I was already here, and it allowed me to be closer because I grew up here in East Lubbock, and she lived not far from here, so I was going every day at lunch and having lunch with her and stuff. So I got to spend those last few months to spend a lot more time with her, and then now she's here.
Washington and her sister selected a property, and her coworker at the time handled the paperwork. When it comes to working with families, helping them through a difficult period and a difficult process, Washington says she lets them take the lead. Often people are sad, sometimes they cry, but that's not always the case.
One time this family was saying, "Oh, you remember that song they used to sing?" So they started singing, and then I was like, "Oh, this is the first time I've ever been serenaded." So, you know, we kind of laugh and everything, but you just have to kind of feel them.
Despite the difficult parts of her job and the strange parts, like paranormal investigators asking to stay in the cemetery overnight, she enjoys it.
And this may be like on a personal note, I've learned to deal with death since coming here, and I didn't have that good of a grip on it before I came here, so.
The cemetery isn't still. It isn't solemnly silent. On any given visit, guests may hear trains pass, birds sing, wind chimes ring. They may see trees, flowers, statues and ornaments, and other visitors paying their respects. And they may see one from Washington's team, making sure this place for history and the memory of loved ones is taken care of. In Lubbock, I'm Samantha Larned.
As we prepare for the Thanksgiving holiday, we want to share some thoughts on gratitude from Glenn Dromgoole.
Two of the most powerful words in the English language are these: thank you. Thank you. So simple, yet so profound. How many times a day do we say those two words? How many more times should we say them or write them? The written thank you note is becoming a lost art, isn't it? I'm certainly not very good at it. I'm more likely to send a thank you note by email or text. It's quicker, it's easier, it's less expensive, and I think that's okay. Your grandmother probably wouldn't agree. She wanted a written thank you, handwritten, mailed, with a stamp, kind of old school. But these days, a simple thank you is certainly preferable to a shrug and a grunt or no response at all. Thank you. Say it. Write it. Send it. Thank you for listening. This is Glenn Dromgoole for the West Texas Dispatch.
Glenn is the writer of some 35 books and runs the Texas Star Trading Company with his wife, Carol. It's time for West Texas Roots. This week, we talked to the owners of Cypress Street Station, a landmark restaurant in historic downtown Abilene, to hear the rich history of that building and how they keep that legacy alive.
The building was built in the 20s. The second story was used as a doctor's office, and then below was like a pharmacy general store that people would travel on the rails, the train, to come see the physicians. So I have a few things. So just looking around at the building, the interior brick are younger than the exterior brick. So at some point that was put in to create two separate entities. I believe it was like a clothing store and a shoe store. I have evidence of a billiard hall. I have evidence of a quilting store. And then I have one couple who the gentleman swears he had an office here, even though his wife says he did not have it. She shakes her head every time, but he swears he had an office here. So that was the original use of the building. It became a restaurant in the late 90s, started by Brian Green and Judy Matthews. Judy Matthews was kind of the money lady, if you will. She thought that downtown Abilene, in order to survive, needed a theater, a museum, and a restaurant. So she put all of her efforts into the Grace Museum, the Paramount Theater, and Cypress Street Station as a restaurant. In the beginning, it was white tablecloths. I think they had some tableside dishes that they would make. Really an upscale dining downtown experience is how it started out. Brian Green was the original operator of the restaurant with Miss Judy Matthews. He passed away unexpectedly, 2015, we'll say. Had an accident and passed away unexpectedly. So the restaurant kind of suffered. It really just kind of bobbled around for a little while, not having a specific identity after he passed. Terry and I came in contact with the restaurant in 2017, ended up buying it from Brian's family. The family that had inherited the restaurant after he had passed didn't know anything about running the restaurant. They didn't even live in Texas. So they were trying to manage everything from afar. They thought it would just run itself. And obviously with the restaurant, that does not happen. So it faltered there for a couple of years before 2017 when Terry and I bought it and then started the identification of what it is today. So we were really intrigued by the history of the original restaurant and what it was intended to be. Terry and I come from a background, like I said, Uncle Julio's before, which is kind of an upscale Mexican food restaurant, and then Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, which is a fine dining establishment. And we kind of put all our skills together to kind of create that fine dining experience in a casual atmosphere that Abilene enjoys. So you're going to see fresh fish on our menu. You're going to see high-end steaks. You're going to have a nice wine list, you know, our bourbon wall, our collection of tequilas, all that kind of stuff, really trying to be very high-end, but still on that casual level that is Abilene. We're not trying to be trendy. You're not going to see all the exciting new trends necessarily shine here at Cypress Street. We're going more for like classic, traditional hospitality experience that you would want while dining. I think we've really taken pride in holding on to the original concept of the restaurant and the experience that people got when they came into this restaurant, the hospitality, just the feel of community and all of the things that we wanted to bring as a restaurant. So really trying to be hospitable to every demographic of diner that wants to come into Cypress Street, because downtown is growing, it's thriving. You know, there are the trendy people who are walking around looking for the newest cocktail. You know, the Chamber has done a couple cocktail competitions, which is fun and brings people around, kind of hitting all the different places and the good kind of collection of things that we have to do downtown. I think Abilene is really embracing the change and all of the new opportunities while still holding on to that classic heritage that we've had for 100 years or so.
This conversation was recorded at Cypress Street Station in downtown Abilene. Welcome back to the West Texas Dispatch. He is the maestro. For 20 years, David Idkin has served as the conductor and music director for the Abilene Philharmonic Orchestra. To say he's left an artistic mark on the city, that would be an understatement. Now he's written a memoir. Right Back Where I Started, it chronicles his life, his career, and a storied life it's been. David, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm so glad we're doing this.
Well, first of all, congratulations, by the way. Terrific opening night on season 75. Yes. The Masterworks concert was wonderful, and you could see people glowing when they walked out of the convention center that night.
It was great. It was one of the largest Masterworks crowds we've ever had in the history of the orchestra. We're very excited.
What a way to kick off season 75, yes. Right? Well, I have to start with this question. Being a theater guy, I have to start with it. Was more than a little surprised to read that as a teen, you were getting roles, you were singing on stage, maybe even just a little bit of dancing when you did Godspell?
Oh, yeah, more than a little, but more than I could manage.
But you did. So your music, obviously you were in percussion. You started off right. On the instrumental side, but you did singing as well.
Yes, I did theater singing. I mean, classical singing came later in my life, but that all comes from our dad, because our dad was an actor and a director, and that endeavor was just in the blood.
So what was it that convinced you, because this is frankly an interesting story, that it was conducting that you needed to be doing musically?
I was always interested in conducting. I don't know why. A young musician, as a pianist, as a drummer, as a trumpet player, and I was always interested in it somehow. And then an opportunity landed in my lap when I was playing for a Broadway show. This is in the West Coast, when I was a teenager still, and I was in a regular orchestra for a Broadway show. And not to get into it in too much detail, but I ended up conducting what was supposed to be very briefly. And I ended up staying at that theater for the better part of 2 years until I needed to go to college.
I'll just say, after reading that story, you have a lot of gumption. Well done. And if you guys want to hear exactly what happened, you need to pick up the book. There's no doubt about that. Of course, the Abilene Philharmonic's second concert was the music of Leonard Bernstein. In your book, you met Leonard Bernstein, and that's a story in itself, isn't it?
Yes, I met Leonard Bernstein for a total of 45 seconds. in Tanglewood, after I was one of the featured performers in his Mass, which was being redone for his 70th birthday celebration, and I was one of the singers in the Mass, and we all got to meet him afterward, briefly, as I said.
Yeah, some part of the story that was interesting was that he didn't seem to recognize you, but he seemed to recognize someone else.
Yes, I had a very relatively short but very memorable solo bit in the Mass, and it's not like anything else in the Mass, so you wouldn't mistake the singer, except that he was already tired, and it was late in the evening by the time we met him, and there was another singer who had a much smaller part, but who looked enough like me that if you were far enough away and didn't know us, and he's, you know, going very quickly through everybody, like I said, maybe 30, 40 seconds with each individual. So he saw the other guy before he saw me, and that singer only told me this about a year ago. All these years, I never knew the reason that Bernstein, like, didn't react when I stepped up to him, like, he didn't seem to know who I was. He thought this other guy was the guy who sang this really difficult high part.
I was going to say, he couldn't hit the five high C's in a row.
Oh, no,
like
there was not.
Did,
that
right?
was never going to happen. He was a bass, actually.
One of the themes that stands out in the book is your travel. And, of course, you would expect a conductor to have been to Europe and the great halls. And, of course, you've done that as well. But you went to the Middle East. That yes. has to have shaped your perspective about the world.
Yeah, in 1987 and 88, I was in the Middle East and Pakistan, which was really, really a revelation to Westerners. And then in four of the Arab Gulf states, which, of course, much wealthier, you know, more, as we said then, first world.
Right, you were in Dubai, correct?
Where we were in Dubai and we were in Qatar. But before that, we were a little over 2 weeks in three different cities in Pakistan, which was just, I mean, it was, I'm very glad I went, I'm very glad I saw it, I'm very glad I experienced it, but boy, it was so revealing about culture and the world and the distribution of wealth in Pakistan and in the world. What's a little sad is that all the things we identified when we were there so many years ago that were problems, cultural and social and political problems, none of it's gotten any better. And that's kind of heartbreaking.
But at the same time, when you see Pakistan in the news, you have this sense of perspective and you go, okay, well, I remember that.
That's why that's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's it like writing a memoir about yourself? Because you've written other books,
weird.
But this is about you.
It's very weird.
Yeah.
It started as a lark. I was tracing some things that I remembered and writing a few things for, just jotting some things down for my kids and for my wife, really, before they went out of my head when I get old or older. and it started to develop into something else. And what really sparked it was I came across a document buried, I imagine we've all done this, buried on my laptop in some folder, a folder that I didn't even remember doing. It was maybe 30 pages of this kind of material. And I had no memory of writing this down. And there was tons of stuff I didn't remember. And I thought, well, that's really interesting because I don't even remember doing this, or yeah. I don't remember the interesting details. And I found all this that I'd jotted down years before. And I said, okay, let's look at this a little more seriously. And then I talked to a publisher and said, if I do this, are you interested? It was actually the publisher that had published my first book about 12 years ago. And interestingly, the publisher, the main editor said to me, you're not famous enough or dead enough for us to probably take this. And I said, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to finish it, and I'm going to give it to you anyway. And then you can tell me no. And he said, great, no worries. And so I finished the first significant draft, and he said, well, we sent this out to other people. They sent it out to peer review, and the reaction we got was fantastic, so we've changed our minds.
Real quick, last question.
Yeah.
How do I get the book if I want to read the book?
You get the book, you get the hard copy of the book on Amazon, or if you want to support our local businesses, which would be great,
yeah,
it is available in hard copy at Texas Star Trading Company. The wonderful people there have it in stock. There's also an audiobook on audible.com.
Awesome. David Itkin, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Right Back Where I Started is available, as you just heard, in several places, including downtown. David Itkin is, of course, the music director and conductor of the Abilene Philharmonic. He's also a professor of music at North Texas and apparently writes books in all the spare time he has between his jobs. This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in, not just today, but since we launched this project 9 months ago. In the spirit of the Thanksgiving holiday, we wanted to express our deep gratitude to this community for listening to our show, for sharing your stories, and for your kind messages and generous support. Thank you. We had help this week from our executive producer, Heather Claiborne, with help from Jordan Herrick and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. I'm George Levesque.